Chapter 8. A quarter of a mile down the steep slope, the pathway turned into a road. No road, really, but two parallel tire-worn indentations in the ground cover. The tracks meandered downward in a tortuous series of hairpin curves. Pitt stumbled along at half-trot, his heart pounding viciously under the taxing strain. He was hurt, not badly, but he had lost much blood. Any doctor who might have encountered him would have immediately confined his torn body to a hospital bed. Over and over, since his escape from the labyrinth, pictures of the defenseless scientists and crew of the first attempt being strafed by the albatross flashed through Pitt's mind. He could see in perfect detail the bullets tearing into flesh and bone, leaving heavy red blotches on the white paint of the oceanographic research ship. The carnage would all be over before the new interceptor jets at Brady Field could scramble, providing, of course, the replacement aircraft had arrived from the North Africa depot before dawn. These visions and others drove Pitt on to efforts beyond his normal capacity. He halted abruptly. Something moved in the shadows ahead. He left the vague trail and circled warily around a thick growth of chestnut trees, creeping closer to the unexpected obstacle. Then he raised up and peered over a fallen, decaying tree trunk. Even in the dim light, there was no mistaking the shape of a well-fed donkey that was tethered to a solitary boulder. The unattended little animal cocked one ear at Pitt's approach and brayed softly, almost pathetically. "You're hardly the answer to a jockey's prayer," said Pitt, grinning, "but beggars can't be choosy." He untied the lead rope from the rock and quickly made a crude halter. With no little amount of patience, he managed to push it over the donkey's nose. Then he mounted. "Okay, mule, giddy up." The little beast did not move. Pitt pounded on the stout flanks. Still no movement. He kicked, bounced, and prodded. Nothing. Not even a bray. The long ears laid flat, and their obstinate owner refused to budge. Pitt did not know any Greek words, only a few names. That must be it, he thought. This dumb jackass was probably named after a Greek god or hero. Forward, Zeus! Apollo! Poseidon! Hercules! How about Atlas? It seemed as though the donkey had turned to stone. Suddenly an idea occurred to Pitt. He leaned over and inspected his mount's underbelly. It was void of exterior plumbing. "My deepest apologies, you gorgeous, ravishing creature," Pitt purred in the pointed ears. "Come, my lovely Aphrodite, let us be off." The donkey twitched, and Pitt knew he was getting warm. "Atlanta?" Nothing more happened. "Athena?" The ears shot up and the donkey turned, looking up at Pitt out of big, confused eyes. "Come on, Athena. Mush!" Athena, much to Pitt's joy and relief, pawed at the ground a couple of times, and then obediently began to amble down the road. The early morning turned cool, and dew was beginning to dampen the forest-trimmed meadows, when at last Pitt reached the outskirts of Laminas. Laminas was an average Greek coastal village, a unique blend of modern construction built on the site of an ancient city, whose ruins rise here and there among the more recent tile-roofed houses. On the shoreline, jutting into the town with a jagged half-moon curve, a harbor full of flat-beamed fishing boats offered a picturesque travel-folder scene with the smells of salt air, fish, and diesel oil thrown in. The wooden-hulled boats lay dead along the beach like a pack of beached whales, their masts carefully stowed along the gunwales and their anchor ropes stretched loosely to seaward. In rows, behind the white sand beach, high vertical poles stood, supporting long fences of stinking brown fishnets. And behind those again was the main street of the village, whose shuttered little doors and windows offered no sign of life to the bedraggled Pitt and his plodding four-legged transportation. The white plastered houses with their tiny balconies made a restful real-life painting in the moonlight, a painting that had little bearing on the events which had brought Pitt to the village. At a narrow intersection, Pitt slid off the donkey and tied it to a mailbox. Then he took an American $10 bill from his wallet and wrapped it into the halter. "Thanks for the lift, Athena, and keep the change." He patted the animal affectionately on the soft, rounded nose, and, hitching up his disreputable-looking pants, walked unsteadily down the street toward the beach. Pitt looked for the telltale lines of a telephone, but could see none. There were no cars or other vehicles parked along the streets either, only a bicycle. But he was too physically drained to consider pedaling the 7 miles back to Brady Field. A lot of good it would do, he thought, even if he could find a phone or someone who owned a car. He couldn't speak Greek. The glowing arms and numbers on the Omega said 3:59. Another hot dawn would hit the island in 41 minutes. 41 minutes to warn Gunn and the men on the first attempt. Pitt looked across the sea, following the inward curve of the island. If it was 7 miles to Brady Field by land, then it was only 4 miles in a direct line across the water to the ship. There was no time left to loiter. He would simply have to steal a boat. Why not, he reasoned. If he could kidnap a donkey, he could pirate a boat. Within a few minutes he found a well-used dory with a high-flaring Carvel hull and a rust-coated one-cylinder gasoline engine. Fumbling in the gloom, his fingers found the throttle linkage and the ignition switch. The flywheel was massive, and it was all Pitt could do to crank it over. Every aching muscle strained at each silent revolution. Sweat broke from his forehead and dripped on the engine. His head throbbed and blurriness crept into his vision. Time after time he pulled the crank handle, rubbing the flesh from his hands. It seemed hopeless. The engine would not fire. If the need for speed had been vital before, it was desperate now. Precious minutes were running down the drain as he attempted to get the bulky engine into action. Pitt reached deep, drawing from the last untapped reservoir of his strength. Clenching his teeth, he gave a mighty pull. The engine popped briefly and died. He pulled the crank again and slumped exhausted into the oily bilge water. The engine coughed once, then twice, wheezed, coughed again, caught, and settled down to a popping thump as the solitary piston began to ram up and down inside its ring-worn sleeve. Too tired to rise, Pitt leaned over and cut the line with the faithful paring knife and kicked the gear lever in reverse. The shabby little boat, its paint peeling down the hull in scaly sheets, chugged backward into the harbor, circled in a 180-degree arc past the old Roman breakwater, and headed out to sea. Pitt jammed the throttle full against its stop as the dory reeled through the low swells, making perhaps a top speed of 7 knots. He hauled himself erect in the stern seat, clutching the tiller tightly between his hands, bleeding from the harsh rasping caused by the rusty crank handle. A half hour passed, an interminable lapse of time under a cloudless sky and a brightening east horizon, and still the boat chugged steadily around the island. The progress seemed agonizingly slow to Pitt, but every foot gained was a foot closer to the first attempt. He caught himself dozing off from time to time, head dropping on his chest, then reawakening with a start. He urged his hazy mind on, driving it with a frenzy he didn't know he possessed. Then his dulled eyes saw it, a low gray shape resting beyond the next small point of land just over a mile away. He recognized the two white 32-point lights on bow and stern that signified a ship at anchor. The probing rays of the sun were rapidly stretching into the sky, clearly silhouetting the first attempt against the eastern horizon. First the superstructure, then the crane and radar mast, then the indiscriminate piles of scientific equipment scattered around the deck. Pitt talked to the noisy old engine, begging it for more revolutions. The lone cylinder snapped, crackled, and popped in reply, turning the warped and bent propeller shaft until it rumbled ominously inside worn and exhausted bearings. The race against the dawn was going to be close. The hot orange ball of the sun was barely poking its dome over the watery horizon when Pitt abruptly slowed the little engine, tardily jammed the throttle in reverse, and bored clumsily into the side of the first attempt. "Hello, the ship!" Pitt shouted weakly, too fatigued to move. "You dumbass," returned an irate voice. "Why don't you watch where you're going?" A shadowed face appeared over the rail and peered down at the dory, bumping against the big ship's hull. Next time, let us know when you're coming so we can paint a target on the side. In spite of the tension and fiery agony of his wounds, Pitt could not help smiling. It's too early in the morning for jokes. Can the wisecracks and get down here and give me a hand. Why should I? Said the lookout, straining his eyes in the early shadows. Who the hell are you? I'm Pitt, and I'm injured. Now stop screwing around and hurry. Is it really you, Major? The lookout asked hesitantly. What the goddamn hell do you want? Snapped Pitt. A birth certificate? No, sir. The lookout vanished behind the railing and a moment later reappeared on the boarding ladder with a boat hook in one hand. He caught the dory on the aft port gunwale and pulled it to the ladder. Securing a line to the little boat's stern, he leaped on board, caught his foot on a cleat, and fell sprawling on top of Pitt. Pitt clamped his eyes shut, grunting from the impact of the other man's weight. When he opened them again, he found himself staring into the yellow beard of Ken Knight. Knight started to say something, but then he more clearly saw the bloody and ragged body beneath him. The sight of Pitt's condition made the young scientist wince, and his face turned ashen. He sat rock-bound in unbelieving shock. Pitt's lips twisted into a bemused grin. Don't waste time sitting there like a broken crutch. Help me to Commander Gunn's cabin. My God, Knight murmured, shaking his head dazedly and slowly from side to side. What in the name of God happened? Later, Pitt snapped, when there's time. He swayed forward onto his hands. Help me, you dumb bastard, before it's too late. There was a desperation, a burning fierceness in Pitt's voice that startled Knight into action. Knight half-carried, half-dragged Pitt up the ladder and onto the deck. He stopped at Gunn's cabin and kicked at the door. Open up, Commander Gunn. It's an emergency. Gunn threw open the door, dressed in nothing but a pair of shorts and his horn-rimmed glasses, looking like a confused professor who was just caught in a motel room with the dean of the university's wife. What's the meaning? He stopped suddenly, staring at the blood-caked apparition supported by Knight. His brown eyes swelled to immense proportions behind the thick lenses. My God, Dirk, is that you? What happened? Pitt tried to smile again, but it was only a slight curl of his upper lip. I'm a dropout from hell. His tone was low, then it came on strongly. Do you have any meteorological equipment on board? Gunn didn't answer. Instead, he ordered Knight to get the ship's doctor. Then the bespectacled little skipper led Pitt into the cabin and gently lowered him on the bunk. Just rest easy, Dirk. We'll have you patched up in no time. That's just it, Rudy. There is no time, Pitt said, grasping Gunn's wrists with his ripped hands. Do you have any meteorological equipment on board? He repeated urgently. Gunn looked down at Pitt, his eyes reflecting bewilderment. Yes, we have instruments to record various meteorological data. Why do you ask? Pitt's hands released their grip and fell away from Gunn's wrists. A smug, cold smile gripped his eyes and spread his lips as he struggled up on his elbows. This ship is going to be attacked any minute by the same aircraft that raided Brady Field. You must be delirious, Gunn said, moving forward to help Pitt sit up. My body may look like hell, but my mind at this minute is sharper than yours, Pitt said. Now listen, and listen closely. Here's what has to be done. It was the lookout perched on the great A-frame crane that first spotted the little yellow plane against its vast blue background. Then Pitt and Gunn saw it too, not more than 2 miles away, flying at 800 feet. They should have seen it sooner, but it was coming at the first attempt straight out of the eye of the sun. He's 10 minutes late, Pitt grunted, holding an arm aloft for a white goateed doctor who worked quickly and skillfully at bandaging his chest. The elderly physician, oblivious to Pitt's movements on the ship's bridge, cleaned and dressed the raw cuts without bothering to turn and look at the approaching plane. He tied the final knot tightly, making Pitt twinge and display a wry face. That's the best I can do for you, Major, until you stop running up and down the deck shouting orders like Captain Bligh. Sorry, Doc, Pitt said without taking his eyes from the sky, but there was no time for a formal office call. You better get below now. If my little battle tactic doesn't work, you're going to do a land office business in about 10 minutes. Without answering, the wiry, deeply tanned doctor closed a large, worn leather case, turned and ducked down the bridge ladder. Pitt drew back from the railing and glanced over at Gunn. Are you connected? Say when. Gunn was tense, but looked ready and eager. He held a small black box in his hand attached to a wire that led up to the radar mast and then into the brilliant morning sky. Do you think the pilot of the old contraption will take the bait? History never fails to repeat itself, Pitt said confidently, glaring at the nearing plane. Even in this moment of tense anxiety, Gunn found time to marvel at Pitt's complete transformation since dawn. The man who staggered on board the first attempt in such fearful physical condition was not the same man who now stood on the bridge with gleaming eyes and the expectant posture of a warhorse, inhaling the scent of battle through flaring nostrils. It seemed strange, but Gunn couldn't stop his mind from drifting back many months ago to the bridge of another ship, a tramp steamer called the Dana Gale. He remembered as though it was only an hour ago, seeing the same expression on Pitt's face just before the old rusty hulk cast off to find and destroy a mysterious seamount in the Pacific north of Hawaii. Abruptly, he was pulled back to the reality of the present by a strong grip on his arm. "Get down," Pitt said urgently, "or the shockwave will blow you overboard. Be ready to join the contact the instant I give the word." The bright yellow plane was banking now, circling around the ship, testing it for defenses. The drone of its noisy engine tore across the water, causing a vibration in Pitt's eardrums. He watched it through a pair of borrowed binoculars, smiling with satisfaction as he noted small round patches in the fabric of the wings and fuselage, a record of Giordino's hits with the carbine. Moving the glasses in a near-vertical angle, he focused on the black wire that led upward, and all at once he felt a hope that began to amount to complete conviction. "Steady, steady," he said quietly. "I think he's going to nibble at the cheese." The cheese, Gunn thought wonderingly. He called that damn balloon up there the cheese. Who would have ever thought that Pitt wanted a damn weather balloon when he asked whether the first attempt carried meteorological gear? Now the damn balloon floated up there in the damn sky with a 100-pound charge of explosives from the damn seismic lab tied to it. Gunn peered above the railing at the big silvery airborne ball and the lethal package dangling beneath it. The cable holding the captive balloon and the electrical wire attached to the explosives both stretched 800 feet high and 400 feet astern, a total distance of 4 football fields away. He shook his head. It was ironic that the explosive charge, normally utilized for producing underwater shockwaves to analyze the bottom of the sea, would now be used to blow an airplane out of the sky. The roar of the plane's engine grew louder, and for one brief moment Pitt thought it was going to dive straight on at the ship. But then he realized that its angle of descent was too low. The pilot was lining the Albatross up for a pass at the balloon. He stood up for a better view, knowing he was a tempting and exposed target. The engine turned into a high-pitched snarl, and the gun sights aimed for the lazy gas bag, waiting above the sparkling water. There was no delay, no adjusting for range. The yellow wings glistened in the sun, obscuring the flashes from the two guns mounted on the cowling. The sound of the staccato bursts and the whine of the bullets signaled the beginning of the attack. The rubberized nylon skin of the helium-filled bag shuddered under the onslaught of the rapid gunfire. It sagged at first, then wrinkled like a prune and collapsed, flapping in loose folds toward the sea. The yellow albatross swept over the dropping balloon, making a beeline for the first attempt. "Now!" Pitt yelled, hitting the deck. Gunn threw the switch. The next instant seemed to march on to infinity. Then there was a gigantic blast which shook the ship from keel to mast. The early morning silence was shattered with a violent sound like the breaking of 1,000 windows by a tornado. And in the sky, a tower of dense smoke and flame swirled in a huge bursting mass of orange and black. The concussion from the explosion knocked the wind from Pitt and Gunn, squeezing internal organs against spines with the sudden punch of a battering ram. Slowly, moving with painful stiffness from the tight bandages and struggling for breath, Pitt rose to his feet and peered into the expanding cloud for signs of the albatross. Shaken for a moment, his eyes darted too high, and he could see nothing but curling smoke. The plane and its pilot were gone. Then he realized what had happened. The brief lag between his shouted signal and the actual explosion saved the plane from instant disintegration. Swinging his gaze down to the horizon, he spotted it. The craft was gliding clumsily through the air, its engine dead. Pitt snatched at the binoculars and quickly sighted them on the albatross. It was trailing smoke and fiery fragments in a meteoric trail. He watched in morbid fascination as one of the lower wings suddenly folded backward and fell away, causing the plane to tumble in a series of wild gyrations, like a piece of paper thrown from a high office building. Then it seemed to hang suspended for a moment before plunging into the sea, leaving a signature of smoke melting into the warm air. "It's down," said Pitt excitedly. "We've scored." Gunn was lying against the far bulkhead corner. He crawled across the deck and lifted his head dazedly. "How far and what heading?" "About 2 miles abaft the starboard beam," replied Pitt. He lowered the glasses and looked at Gunn's pale face. "Are you all right?" Gunn nodded. "Just lost a little wind, that's all." Pitt smiled, but there was little humor in his eyes. He was smugly satisfied with himself, very pleased with the outcome of his plan. "Send the double ender and some men out there to dive on the wreck. I'm anxious to find out what our ghost looks like." "Of course," said Gunn. "I'll personally lead the diving party, but only on one condition. You get your ass down to my cabin immediately. The doc hasn't finished with you yet." Pitt shrugged. "You're the captain." He turned back to the rail and looked again at the spot that marked the grave of the yellow albatross. He was still at the rail 10 minutes later when Gunn and four of the first attempt's crew loaded their diving gear on the double-ender whaler and cast off. The little boat made no attempt to circle and search the general surface area, but moved straight to the spot where the plane disappeared. Pitt watched until he could see the divers drop into the sparkling blue water at intervals to converge together underwater at the final resting place of the wreck. "Come along, Major," said a voice at his elbow. He slowly turned and looked into the face of the bearded doctor. "It's no use chasing me, Doc. I won't marry you," Pitt said, a wide grin riding his face. The blue-eyed old ship's surgeon did not grin back. He merely pointed down the ladder at Gunn's cabin. Pitt had no choice but to wearily resign himself and turn his battered body over to the doctor's care. In the cabin, he fought a half-hearted battle against unconsciousness, but the administered sedatives won a beachhead, and soon he was sheathed in a deep sleep.